This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review program. We're going to survey the most important news from all over the world. I have with me here some of our writing staff, and I want to give each of them a chance to give us an idea of what they have in mind for the program today, starting with Robert Morley.
Well, today we'll be talking about debt and warnings coming from an individual who is very immersed in the global financial situation, statements coming from the Economic Summit in Davos.
Also, Brent Noctegal.
I'm going to be talking about a secret pact that was done between Russia and Syria about the terms of engagement inside Syria and how that is worrying Israeli officials.
We also have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be here. And today I'll be talking about the Western view that many people have of Russian President Vladimir Putin. We see him as kind of the John Wayne of the world of politics. There's a lot of admiration for him. And I'll be discussing a story that shows that this is a dangerously naive view.
And also via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Oh, it's great to be here. And today I'd like to talk about a new phase in the German political crisis. Angela Merkel is coming under pressure like never before. And a lot of people are asking, can she last 2016?
Our top story this week is Iran. As we discussed on our program on Wednesday, January 16th was implementation day. The nuclear deal with Iran went into effect. Economic sanctions were lifted on this terrorist sponsoring state. This is a huge landmark moment for the Middle East and for the world. This really puts a stamp of finality on anointing Iran the king of the South. And this is a process that we at the Trumpet have talked about a lot for more than 20 years. Iran was really ascending already. We were talking about this even back into the 1990s, but we've really seen it ramp up since America began intervening in the region when it launched the War on Terror back in 2001. It started by striking Afghanistan, and then it went after Iraq rather than going after the head of the terrorist snake, Iran. Mr. Stephen Fleury has been drawing attention on the Trumpet Daily program to these statements that we were making in articles back at that time, including this from the November 2001 Trumpet edition. Make no mistake about it, Iran is the head of the snake. And it said, we can see unequivocally that the terrorist snake will survive America's aggression, head intact and stronger than ever. And now here we are with implementation day. These are the kinds of statements that we're seeing. This is from Charles Krauthammer's column published January 21st. It says, implementation day marked a historic inflection point in the geopolitics of the Middle East. In a stroke, Iran shed almost four decades of rogue state status and was declared a citizen of good standing of the international community, open to trade, investment, and diplomacy. This without giving up or even promising to change its policy of subversion and aggression. This without having forfeited its status as the world's greatest purveyor of terrorism. This is just a remarkable moment in world history. Krauthammer continues, overnight it went not just from pariah to player, but from pariah to dominant regional power, flush with $100 billion in unfrozen assets and virtually free of international sanctions. The oil trade alone will pump tens of billions of dollars into its economy. He quotes President Rouhani talking just the day after implementation day. He's predicting 5% economic growth in the country. This is a country that has just been hemorrhaging and contracting for quite a long time before these negotiations started a couple of years ago. And now he's talking about 5% growth. On Saturday, Krauthammer continues, the Iranian transport minister announced the purchase of 114 Airbuses from Europe. This inaugurates a rush of deals binding European companies to Iran. Another quote, cash rich, reconnected with global banking and commerce, and facing an Arab world collapsed into a miasma of raging civil wars, Iran has instantly become the dominant power of the Middle East. Now, again, this is just really the stamp of finality to a process that has been going on for quite a long time. But Krauthammer really might have used the words King of the South. I mean, that's what he's discussing. That's the terminology that we reference all the time regarding Iran. That's the language that's used in the prophecy of Daniel 11 and verse 40. Iran is the king, and everybody can see it. And the thing that really astounds me in looking at this story is just how much the United States is responsible for this having taken place. We're talking about the Trumpet Weekly. This is our weekly news report where we collate the best stories from all kinds of sources. And this week's edition is full of stories showing just how weak America has been in allowing this and really encouraging this remarkable development. I want to just pitch it over to Brent Noctegal for some of the details of just what's happened just in the last week, right around Implementation Day, directly before and right after.
Right. Implementation Day, there was another event that took place that was trying, was a move by the American administration to just show how positive this was. And that was the release of a number of Americans that had been detained in Iran for different lengths of time. And while that is a good thing to happen, there are some other circumstances surrounding their release that shows just how much America was giving up in order to make this release. There is a report inside the Trumpet Weekly from the Business Insider, and that quotes a CBS report where the State Department knew a week before Implementation Day that there were some Shiite militia groups in Iraq that, you know, answer to Iran, that were wanting to take some Americans captive inside Iraq. And yet, the State Department said to CBS that they had hoped that Iran would tell the Shiite militia to hold off from taking these Americans captive till after Implementation Day, because on Implementation Day they had Americans going to be released, and yet the same day it turned out there was three Americans that were taken captive in Iraq. Look what they were willing to. Obviously, the Iranians didn't follow through and didn't care what the United States was going to say about the Shiite militia taking Americans captive. It just shows again what America has given up to this unchanged Iranian empire.
Right. This Business Insider report, it talks about how they just wanted to do anything possible to preserve this photo op. You know, this heartwarming story about American prisoners being brought home the very day this deal is implemented. This is what they fill the news with. The very day that $100 billion starts flooding into Iran, American media are focused on these prisoners. And the narrative from the White House is, wow, this is terrific evidence of the power of diplomacy. But as you said, look what they gave up. The Business Insider report also talks about the fact that they held off imposing sanctions on the individuals connected with the ballistic missile program until after the exchange and the deal were finalized last Saturday. The imminent prisoner swap might also have explained why the U.S. did not respond more forcefully to videos Iran released of American sailors detained in its waters last week, according to another State Department official or former State Department official. This is just all of the evidence of what the United States wanted to just allowed to happen, and just giving Iran the freedom to act this way without taking any kind of punitive measures against it because they didn't want to jeopardize this prisoner swap. This is just a phenomenal evidence of American weakness in the face of Iranian strength. And there's so much evidence, and we've been talking about it for several weeks, of just how the Iran is operating with absolute impunity. They have no fear of American retribution against the way that they're conducting themselves. The Krauthammer article also mentions the fact that just within hours of implementation, the regime disqualified 2,967 of roughly 3,000 moderate candidates from even running in parliamentary elections next month. This is the status quo. Nothing has changed at all politically in Iran. This is the way the Islamic Republic has always conducted its business. And really, everything the United States has done has encouraged this and strengthened this position. One more quote from the Business Insider report. Once implementation is announced, Iran is going to step up its provocative actions in the region, and hardliners know this White House won't do a thing about it for the next 12 months. That is absolutely all of the evidence shows just how accurate that assessment is. We also have in this week's Trumpet Weekly commentary by Brett Stevens at the Wall Street Journal, just talking about all of these latest signs that the United States wants to hold up as, you know, evidence of a new and improved Iranian regime. He says, is it really, or is it just evidence of that it's being given good reasons to believe it can always extract a bribe for its bad behavior? Any country that believes it will never be made to pay the price for the risks it takes will take ever greater risks. And he says, Iran will become a normal country only when it ceases to be an Islamic republic. In the meantime, the only question is how far we are prepared to abase ourselves in our quest to normalize it. This is really something that we, two major prophecies that we have talked about time and time again, the rise of the King of the South, the decline of Anglo-America, and the breaking of the American will. One last quote from Charles Krauthammer. He said, in 1938, the morning after Munich, Europe woke up to Germany as the continent's dominant power. Last Sunday, the Middle East woke up to Iran as the regional hegemon with a hand often predominant in the future of Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and the Gulf Arab states, and in time, in the very survival of Israel. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review. We're looking at the most important stories from around the world, and I'd like to turn now to Europe. So, Richard, the big story that you have up on thetrumpet.com today, Merkel has 2 months to fix migrant crisis. She's facing a lot of pressure from Edmund Stoiber and from the sister party that she's aligned with. Can you tell us more about this, just what's happening here, what these politicians are saying, and the kind of pressure this puts on her?
Well, Spiegel this week asked in the title of one of their articles, is this Angela Merkel's last stand? So she definitely is coming under much more pressure than ever. And we really are seeing a new phase now in the German political crisis. I think, we've been talking about this going back 6 months or so now about how this migrant crisis is going to cause her some big problems. But what I want to get across today is now it's different and now it's worse. So back when we were talking about this maybe in the autumn, there were still a good number of people saying, you know, actually, she's still doing fine. An absolutely stellar level of support of around 75%, down about 50%, which is still pretty respectable. When she spoke about the migrant crisis at the party conference, she got this huge round of applause and a standing ovation. It just went on and on. So there were some kind of things that, or some people saying, well, she's going to be okay. But now that's changing. As Spiegel wrote this week in that article, a long claim, the Köln attacks. And since then, everything has changed, both in Merkel's party and across the country, they wrote. So, and not only do we see those Köln attacks, but then Merkel's whole solution has revolved around Turkey and stopping the migrants from getting into Europe in the first place. And that's completely fallen apart. Turkey has completely failed to do that. Their idea, her plan of redistributing refugees around Europe has failed completely. They wanted to redistribute getting close to 200,000. They've barely managed 200. So everything that she's tried so far has failed, and things are getting a lot worse for her.
And it's basically like she's trying to find some way to accommodate this, some way to have a solution that doesn't involve just border security. And these other politicians are saying it's time for a real solution now.
Right. Horst Seehofer and the CSU that you mentioned at the start, they're saying that if Merkel does not get her act together soon, they're going to take the border security situation to the German Constitutional Court.
I would like to draw attention to this article that you wrote about Edmund Stoiber, because he's obviously a personality that we have focused on quite a bit in the past. Maybe you could give us a brief summary of how, what sort of role he plays and why he's important for us to watch.
Well, he was actually the individual that Merkel beat in order to get the conservative to stand on the conservative platform for the chancellery. He had a shot before Merkel as well. So he was a major player. He has been talked about and is still talked about as a possible president of Germany. He's been the premier of Bavaria, the Bavarian prime minister for a while. So he is one of the most senior figures in the Christian Social Union and one of the most senior statesmen in Germany. Now, he's been out of politics for the past few years. He kind of retired and did some work at the European Union. And back in 2007, he's generally refrained from talking about politics. But now he is getting very vocal and he's quite intentionally seeking out publicity and really very strongly criticizing Miss Merkel and saying, you know, if she, he basically said that Merkel has got until March to fix the crisis. If she doesn't change her mind, he said that the spring elections are going to be a disaster. And if at that point, if that happens, he said that they'll have to start working against the will of Miss Merkel within the CDU, within Merkel's party, and kind of left this threat hanging in the air of the CSU working to unseat Angela Merkel if she doesn't change the way she's dealing with this crisis.
How remarkable is it to hear this kind of rhetoric coming from someone of Stoiber's stature? You know, the way that he's talking about we need to handle this situation, it seems like that's been more kind of on the fringe. But now here you've got Stoiber stepping up and saying this about Merkel. And, you know, I mean, we've been talking about the possibility of someone stepping into her position for a long, long time.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say that the talk of border security has been on the fringe, especially not within the CSU. I mean, Mr. Foley's cover article for The Trumpet in December were on some comments that Stoiber made in the autumn about along a very similar line on the same subject. And Horst Seehofer really has been talking about this issue since the summer. So I think it's more an intensification of a loud voice that has been coming from that side of the party for a long time. Though I do think it is, I mean, the Spiegel article notes that they write the number of queries from unsettled Germans who have nothing to do with xenophobic movements like Pegida or other right-wing groups has increased significantly.
Right.
So you are definitely seeing this subject go more from the fringe to the mainstream. But I think a lot of that shift took place 6-9 months ago as well.
So with this kind of pressure coming from so high up within her government, how does this affect Merkel practically going forward?
Well, as Stoiber brought out in what we wrote up in that article, really all eyes are now turned to significant local elections that are coming up within March. So then Miss Merkel, there'll be a couple of governorships that are coming up that actually her party could potentially lose. The Alternative for Deutschland, more far-right party, they're polling on around 10%, which is huge for them. On the face of it, 10%, you know, okay, well, that's not big enough to take over the country. But 10% is absolutely big enough to take a lot of voters away from Miss Merkel and cause Miss Merkel to lose out. So with these elections that are coming up, there's a real chance that she could lose two governorships. This has caused the downfall of German chancellors in the past. And, you know, really any threat to Miss Merkel is going to have to come from within the EU to stand a chance of getting rid of her. And as this article in Spiegel brings out, we are starting to see that agitation already. They wrote in here, you know, thus far there was a consensus that we had to solve the problem with Merkel at the helm. Now some are saying we have to solve the problem without Merkel if necessary. That is still a minority, but it is a growing minority. And even one of Miss Merkel's own supporters said if they don't get a handle on this over the next couple of months, then we would be facing a power struggle. So March is really, and these elections coming up in March now are the significant things to watch, because if Miss Merkel's party does badly then, because of the immigration crisis, then you're going to see people within her own party working to get rid of her and replace her with someone who's going to handle things differently.
A pretty remarkable development that just brings to mind this prophecy that we've drawn so much attention to over the years about the inevitability of a strong German leader rising, and to see the pressure on a woman who's been really the most popular politician in Germany, if not the world, for quite a long time. Just knowing that there's going to be a political change here, we see those forces coming into play very strongly right now.
Now you're seeing more and more people who are coming out and saying this really could be for her.
We're going to turn our attention now to something quite different. We're going to go over to an economic story from Robert Morley.
Yes, so William White, he came out with what people are calling a scathing review of the global economic system. William White, of course, is the chairman of the OECD, the Organization for Economic and Cooperation and Development. Currently, he was also the chief economist for the Bank for International Settlements. And he's over in Davos in Switzerland with many other leading economic thinkers discussing the global economy, trying to come up for solutions for the global economy. And he came out this week and said that the global financial system has become dangerously unstable and faces an avalanche of bankruptcies. And he said it's going to test the social and political stability of the system, of the world. He said that, quote, the situation is worse than it was in 2007. Continuing on, he said, our macroeconomic ammunition to fight downturns is essentially all used up. He said that debts have continued to build up over the past 8 years, and they've reached levels that are so high in every part of the world that they've become a potent cause for mischief. And then he continued on and said that it will become obvious in the next recession that many of these debts will never be serviced or repaid. And this will be uncomfortable for a lot of people who think they own assets that are worth something. So he's warning that there's a lot of debt in the system. He's repeating a lot of these comments that others at the Davos Economic Summit have stated, that debt levels are at record highs. They have not abated. They've kept on growing through the 2000 and after the 2000 economic recession. And now the world's at this point where they're becoming very, very dangerous.
It's always bad news with you, isn't it, Robert?
Well, what I find most interesting about what William White is saying is a solution to the problem. What he's saying the world needs to do. And this is what he said. He said, the only question is whether we are able to look reality in the eye and face what is coming in an orderly fashion, or whether it will be disorderly. He said, debt jubilees have been going on for 5,000 years. As far back as the Sumerians. I think this...
He's talking about just hitting a reset button.
Right, hitting a reset button. And anybody who's familiar with the Old Testament knows that this is a concept that's in the Bible, this idea of debt jubilee, basically wiping out the debts, canceling them off, and starting over. Now, the difference, of course, is this isn't going to be like the way it worked in the Bible. In the Bible, when people lent money, they knew that this debt jubilee was coming, and they could prepare for that, and that was all built into the system. Well, this... won't be like that at all, because most people out there were planning on getting their money back with interest. And what he's saying is that it isn't going to be like that. The government's going to have to step in, and the government, again, is going to be choosing a lot of winners and losers, and there's going to be a lot of pain coming from this.
It is interesting to hear someone of his stature bringing that particular solution, that it's almost like that was every 50 years that debts were canceled, and it was a way of purging some of the toxic buildup of debt and other economic problems that are kind of naturally there when you have human economic interactions. And he can recognize that it needs to be there. It's just, when you're talking about on the scale of what is happening in the world today, this would be like, this would cause world war.
Absolutely. It would cause world war. And I think, we can talk a little bit about that too, because we have this other article in the Trumpet Weekly. This is something that was written, I think it was published in the Washington Times. And this author writing in the Washington Times said that a lot of people are starting to make comparisons today to what happened in 2007 and what happened in 2000 before we had these last two bubbles go. But he said that's a mistake. He said that we need to be going further back in history than that. He said it's not the crash that we need to worry about. It's what comes after the crash. And he says, for an example, we should be looking back to what happened in 1937, of course. That was the years prior to the start and the outbreak of World War II. And he just goes through history and gives example after example of how economic crisis has led to wars and revolutions. And he makes this point that there seems to be this repeat of history that happens over and over and over again. He says it happens somewhere around every 80 years or so, but he just gives a lot of examples. And I thought the article is just very interesting. He says, you know, 80 years before 1937, the last one that led to World War II, the last big economic problem, you know, the Great Depression, the aftermath of the Great Depression that led to World War II. He said you can go back 80 years before that in 1857. That was just a couple of years before they had this great panic that hit a lot of the financial sector. That led to the Civil War in the United States. He goes back 80 years before that. He said there was the credit crisis of 1772, just prior to the Revolutionary War in the United States. And he just goes back, talks about in the 1690s, the economic crisis then that preceded the war of the Spanish Succession. And he just goes back through history. And it is very interesting how tightly related big economic crashes and big economic problems are to social instability, to wars and to revolutions. And he's warning that it's not the economic crash that we're going to have this year or the recession we might have in 2016. It's what comes next after that. And you know, as we've been talking about, debt levels are so much higher. The instability is so much higher. We have leading figures talking about debt jubilees of all things. We need a reset. This is the kind of context that this is all taking place in.
Well, maybe following that Old Testament law about every 50th year would prevent those 80-year cycles of decline that he's talking about there. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the stories that Robert and the rest of us are talking about. They're in this week's edition of the Trumpet Weekly. This is a report that we put together every week with the most significant stories from around the world. It is free. I'd like to encourage you to go online to thetrumpet.com, and you can join over 32,000 subscribers who receive this free report every week in their email inbox. Coming up, we have more news from the Middle East and from Russia. And later on in the program, we have our lightning round of important headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You're listening to our Week in Review program. We'll start our second segment with another story out of the Middle East, and for that, we'll turn to Brent.
Someone we like to follow from the Jerusalem Post, a columnist over there, is Carolyn Glick. And on January 18, she wrote an editorial there entitled Israel and the Russian Challenge. And this is what she said at the beginning of that. When Russian President Vladimir Putin deployed his forces to Syria last year, he claimed that the deployment would be brief. But last week, when the terms of the deployment agreement concluded between Russia and Syria were made public, we discovered that those claims were false. She's referring to a document that was released that showed a secret pact between the Syrians and the Russians that was signed on August 26 before they told the world that they were going to be engaged inside Syria, the Russian Air Force and the Russian military. And the details of this agreement are quite stunning. It shows that Russia is going to be, or at least they attempt to be, inside Syria for a long time. There's an open-ended time commitment to this. They can be there. Either side can pull out of the agreement, but then there's going to have to be a whole year that passes before the other power, or before Russia would have to leave. Russian military personnel and shipments can pass in and out of Syria at will, and they're not subject to Syrian authorities at all. They can do whatever they like, bringing whatever they want into the country. Syrians, though, they can't enter Russian bases without Russia's permission as well. Russia claims that in the agreement that they don't have to have They don't have any responsibility for damage or civilian casualties whatsoever. They can do exactly what they want inside Syria. Now, this leaked agreement is worrying for Israel because they probably considered that Russia would be there briefly, stabilize Assad, and then leave. But it looks like they've got greater long-term plans. Now, this is worrying for a number of reasons, but the main one for the Israelis is that they have a large foreign military on their doorstep that has removed themselves or Israel as being the dominant military power in the Middle East. It was the fact that until Russia was there, that they were able to push back on any Arab army, any Arab air force. The only reason they still exist is the fact that they were more powerful than their Arab enemies. Now, it's not anything new that Russia is down in there, but the big difference is that there is no America to check the Russian superpower down in the Middle East.
Right, and it's not always easy to unpuzzle what Russia is up to, what its what its next move might be, and how that would impact Israel's policy.
Right. I mean, I don't think the Israelis believe that Israel's the next stop on the Russian military's doorstep, or the next stop that their next engagement. There's plenty else for them to do before they would eventually, if they did decide to take out Israel. But they're worried now, Israel, is that they no longer have full power even over the skies over Israel. They've got Russian anti-aircraft defenses that are set up in Syria that protrude halfway into Israeli territory. They're not free to go about their raids on convoys that pass through Syria from Iran to Hezbollah to blow them up without first thinking, what is Russia going to do at this point?
Right, and there's also been a tremendously highly publicized collusion between Russia and Iran. And even though there have been some indications that maybe that relationship isn't just as brotherly as some other indications might be, it's still Russia has definitely had a huge role in propping up Iran and providing it with nuclear capacity and so on, so Israel's kind of caught in the middle, and really that's staring down its major enemy in the region with Russian backing.
Right. It would really play into the decision making of Israelis knowing that how much Russia wants the Syrian regime to stay intact. They were willing to move large amounts of troops. They were willing to move some of their ships. They were willing to move a lot of their aircraft. They were willing to fight on foreign soil to prop up Assad. So the Israelis, knowing that if they ever wanted to remove Assad from power, or if they were worried that Syria was going to attack them, they would have the Russians to deal with as well.
This Carolyn Glick article talks quite a bit about Russian support for Hezbollah. That is a real concern. Maybe you could just help us to understand why Russia would be colluding with Hezbollah.
Well, this is one point that I don't know if I would fully disagree with her on this point, but there were reports that came out a couple of weeks ago that Russians were selling ammunitions to Hezbollah, and that was reported on by two Hezbollah officials. So they would want to give some credence to that story, or push that story that they're being backed completely by Russia. So we'll see how much Russia really does back up Hezbollah. I tend to think that Russia is there mainly to strengthen Syria, and to even, perchance, by the end of this, actually limit Iran's power over the Syrian dictator, Bashar al-Assad. I mean, Iran over the past 10 years has replaced Russia as the chief financier of the Syrian regime. But I think Russia wasn't too happy that they couldn't call the shots in Syria like they used to through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So while Russia is willing to work with Iran, for the moment, I think that looking forward, we might be able to see that there may be a break there.
Well, as she brings out, it definitely it's clear just how limited Israel is in the actions that it's able to take against Russia, particularly compared to, say, what it might be able to do against some of the powers within the region. It's made strong strong incursions against Syria, for example, striking its nuclear program some years back. Whereas when you're talking about bumping up against Russia in that kind of fashion, it would be a lot more, give you a lot more pause before you would do that.
For sure.
Well, thank you, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. And this talk of Russia brings us to another big story from this past week, information on some of the other activities of one Vladimir Putin. And for that story, we will go to Jeremiah.
Yes, well, it looks like Vladimir Putin most likely approved the murder of former Russian intelligence agent Alexander Litvinenko, which happened back in 2006. That's the conclusion of a long-awaited report that was published this Thursday by the British government. The British have been investigating this assassination because it happened on British soil there in London. And British officials spent about 9 years examining all of the evidence and assembling a 328-page document. And it basically says that it would have been almost impossible for this murder to have happened the way it did without involvement from the Russian government and without Putin himself signing off on it. And that's largely because Litvinenko was poisoned with polonium-210. That's a radioactive substance that was slipped into his drink while he was staying at a hotel there in London. And it was slipped into his drink by two high-level Russians with close government ties. And the British report says that the use of polonium-210 was, quote, at the very least, a strong indicator of Russian state involvement, as it had to be made in a nuclear reactor. So this poisoning consigned Litvinenko to a slow and painful death. It took about 22 days from the radiation poisoning. And this new report by the British government says that all of the evidence shows that Putin and his men carried out this barbaric murder in order to send a message. And if you know a little bit of the backstory, it's easy to see what that message was. Mr. Litvinenko had fled Russia in the year 2000, saying that he was being persecuted for his anti-Kremlin journalism. So he went to live in the UK. He was granted asylum in the UK, and he eventually gained British citizenship. And in the years before his death, he was continuing to work as a writer and a journalist, and his work was quite critical of the Kremlin in general and of Putin in, specifically. He exposed all kinds of corruption scandals and criminal behaviors that were happening there. And it's likely also that he was working for the British intelligence agencies at that point, specializing in fighting against Russian organized crime. So from Putin's perspective, Litvinenko was a traitor. Putin sent a powerful message by having him killed that basically said Putin will not tolerate turncoats and traitors, and Putin will use force to deal with his enemies. So it's a sobering story, but it's very important because it shows that the Western view of Vladimir Putin and of the upper echelons of the Kremlin is wrong. So many in the U.S. and Europe see Putin as kind of a delightfully mischievous character. Right. Many are just amused by his kind of tough guy persona. And there's even a lot of admiration for his resolve and his masculinity, because it's just the opposite of what we see in so many Western leaders that are just soft and handcuffed by political correctness. So we a lot of people are really drawn to Putin because he's the opposite of that. Many view him as kind of the John Wayne of the world of politics. But this view is wrong. And it's a dangerous misreading, I think, of Vladimir Putin. And this new story, which shows his culpability in that terrible murder, just really proves, I think, that we should not admire this man. We shouldn't see him as a delightfully mischievous character.
Right. Brad McDonald actually wrote that article, Fear This Man. That's really the essence of it, isn't it? Stephen Fleury was talking about that this morning on the Trumpet Daily program, and just how here is very strong evidence that showed, really backed up the message in that Brad McDonald article. He talked, you know, back in history, here's a former KGB agent with a lot of blood on his hands from past, and so many of the incidents even intervening. This is one more example that shows this pattern. But the point that Mr. Fleury brought out this morning was here you had the it's a British inquiry into these actions, and it was Britain that was just a few days ago the Parliament trying to figure out whether they should ban Donald Trump from the country. Well, where's the debate over what to do with Vladimir Putin when he's literally getting away with murder? You know, it's just a really powerful illustration of just how you know the state of British politics today that they would be that off the mark.
Yes, it's a really, really shameful hypocrisy and dangerous naivety also about President Putin. And I would just strongly encourage listeners to read that article by Mr. McDonald. It does a powerful job of just painting the full picture of why we should fear Vladimir Putin.
Well, thank you, Jeremiah. And we have another story out of Europe this week. And for that story, we will turn to Richard. Richard, we were talking earlier about just the pressure on Angela Merkel in Germany because of this migrant crisis. And really, we have a story in this week's Trumpet Weekly that kind of shows the bigger picture and how the same crisis is affecting Europe more broadly and the pressure on other governments and the steps that they're taking to combat it. Can you tell us about that?
At Davos this week, for example, George Soros said that the EU is on the verge of collapse. And this is really the growing consensus now among EU leaders. So he said that Merkel correctly foresaw the potential of the migrant crisis to destroy the European Union. What was a prediction has become a reality. And then he said, now it's time for Germans to decide, do they want to accept the responsibilities and the liabilities involved in being the dominant power in Europe? Now, that's some very insightful comment to think at the end. But in terms of his seeing Europe on the brink of collapse, that's not rare now. For the French president, Manuel Valls, he said the European project can die, not in decades or years, but very fast if we're unable to face up to the security challenge. Sigmar Gabriel, the German vice chancellor, said the EU is on the brink of catastrophe. Mark Rutte, the Dutch prime minister, he said the EU needs to get a grip on the migration crisis within the next 5 to 8 weeks. And he said the current numbers aren't sustainable. We are running out of time. So there is a building sense of crisis. And related to that, Austria, this week, they announced that they would only take in 37,500 asylum seekers this year. Last year, they had 90,000 apply for asylum. So they're going against what Germany wants in announcing this cap. It is probably against EU law. It's probably even against the Geneva Convention. So you're really starting to see these kind of human rights norms that Europe has upheld for so long completely breaking down.
It reminds me of the article that Brad McDonald wrote where he was talking about just those European ideals that were they upheld for so long in time of peace, how those are being challenged and broken down because of the realities of the world today and geopolitics and how they just don't hold up.
It also exposes just the European hypocrisy that they've had for the past 5 to 10 years. You know, another article we have in the Trumpet Weekly from Robert Kaplan mentions that now it's becoming increasingly obvious that this human rights kind of mindset that Europe had that you mentioned has only been possible because there's been a ring of brutal dictators across the Middle East and North Africa essentially running prison states and stopping migrants getting to Europe. And so they're not able to function that way and keep up this kind of very hypocritical and pretensive human rights concerns. And so they're turning people away. I mean, related to this, another article from the Trumpet Weekly I'd kind of like to shoehorn in there is that there's growing talk of Germany getting more involved in Libya. And the leader of the Left Party in Germany was talking about Germany doing what he called a dirty deal with the militia groups in Libya, saying, we'll prop you up militarily if you stop the migrants. So we're also seeing these kind of human rights norms dissolve when it comes to foreign policy as well.
Well, Richard, that's exactly what Brent is going to talk about next. Brent, can you give us some more details about this, what's happening in Libya and this proposed German incursion?
Right. There's a big reason why they're willing to do this dirty deal inside Libya, exchanging foreign firepower and cash even to ensure that they didn't they're able to control their borders to stop the migrant influx. And that's because the Islamic State there in Libya, even as we reported last week, is just getting a greater hold on that chaotic nation. There is an article inside the Trumpet Weekly entitled "A Terror State in Libya," and it's what the Wall Street Journal chose for their editorial on January 18. And it talks about how Islamic State actually launched a naval assault in northern Libya in the past week and attacking some oil terminals. They were on three separate boats and they came in from the ocean and started, you know, attacking this oil depot to try and disrupt the oil production out of Libya. And this is really interesting just because just off the coast of Libya as well is we have this EU mission, Operation Sophia, as brought out in the article that Richard was talking about, where there's German ships right there. Obviously, they didn't, you know, come into contact with each other, but they're really close to one another to think that both of them are in those Mediterranean waters and that we could see soon some type of military action with a European power directly against the Islamic State, not from the air. Now, that would be a massive ratcheting up of tensions between Europe and the Islamic State. I won't go into too many more details of just how much Libya is in chaos, but we know that they've tried to form a interim government there in Libya, as Richard said, trying to cobble together some of these militias that are against ISIS to try and stop it becoming a complete terrorist state. We've got the Europeans being extremely worried what's going on there. And another part of the article that Richard didn't go into is the fact that they are willing to send ground forces, it seems, European ground forces into Libya to put a stop to the Islamic State's rise there, if need be.
Just the tensions between, the tensions that the Middle East is causing, the problems that it's causing to Europe, and just Europe's involvement in that region. It just, you can see this building and building and building. And it, all just extremely relevant from a biblically prophetic standpoint. We'll keep watching that region. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we're talking about on the program today are in this week's edition. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Richard.
On January 16th, the German finance minister called for an EU-wide petrol tax to pay for the cost of the migrant crisis. Now, we've talked about how the migrant crisis is pushing Europe apart, but we've also talked about how the solution to that crisis will bring Europe together. And this tax is a great example of this. A Europe-wide tax would be a major step forward towards a superstate. It's something very practical. It's something that Schäuble has been pushing for a long time, and now he's using the migrant crisis to make the case for that.
All right, thanks. We'll go now to Brent.
Al-Shabaab militants, they attacked a beachfront restaurant in Somalia today, and they killed more than 20 people in this. And this just comes after a week after they attacked Kenyan peacekeepers as well in Somalia. And when we reported that last week, we talked about how right now there is this movement inside Somalia and inside Al-Shabaab to try and show themselves as the dominant terrorist group, because Islamic State is stealing their fighters.
All right, we'll go now to Jeremiah.
Beards. We don't discuss facial hair very often on the Trumpet Hour, but beards made the news this week in a really significant way when the government of Tajikistan cut off the beards of about 13,000 of the nation's Muslim men. Many sects of Islam say men have to wear beards as a demonstration of their devotion and piety to the faith of Islam. And so this is part of Tajikistan's fight against Islamic influence within its borders. Around the same time, officials also closed 160 shops that sold Muslim clothing, and they passed laws prohibiting new parents from giving their children Arabic-sounding names. So Tajikistan's leadership is mostly secular, and they're always worried about Islamic influence spilling across the border there from Afghanistan. And shaving off all of those beards and these other moves show that Tajikistan is pushing hard against Islamism.
Robert, what you got?
Well, there's more than 500,000 visitors that overstayed their visas in the United States during 2015. This is part of a new Homeland Security Department report that was released on Tuesday. It said that many of them have just drifted into the shadows to join the more than 11 million illegal immigrants who are already in the United States. And one of the things that was most disturbing about this report is how so many of those that overstayed their visas are from what the Homeland Security Department called special interest countries. These are nations that are considered to be training grounds for terrorists. And they had extremely high rates of overstays. Nations like Afghanistan, who had 11% of the people who came here overstayed their visa. Iraqis, 7% overstayed. Syrians, 6.5% overstayed. And the Department of Homeland Security even said that it's trying to figure out better ways to improve its data collection because it can't track who's actually still in the country and who has actually left. So pretty condemning report.
We'll go now to Richard.
Jews living in Germany no longer feel safe. That's what a spokesman for the Jewish community in Hamburg said this week. He said that this was because of the growing extreme right wing in Germany. And then also their failure at dealing with radical Islam coming into the country. How a country treats its Jews can often be a good barometer for extremism and the political climate there. And so that exposes a dangerous political climate brewing now within Germany.
Well, I'll just slip one in here. Officials at Portland Community College designated April Whiteness History Month. The website says it's not a celebratory endeavor, as is Black History Month, but it seeks to challenge, quote, the master narrative of race and racism through an exploration of the social construction of whiteness. They're going to have panel discussions and films and lectures, seminars and so on, covering a lot of topics like who benefits from the consequences of whiteness, who loses from whiteness, what are the roles and responsibilities of white people and people of color in dismantling whiteness. So more exciting efforts to solve the problems of racism in America. We'll go now to Brent.
The United States State Department this week, they came out and supported a European Union decision to ensure that goods from the West Bank region in Israel were properly labeled. They would be distinguished. No longer can they have a Made in Israel stamp. They are going to have to say made in, I don't know, Palestinian territories, occupied territories, in a really bad place where Israel's doing really bad things, something like that. We're not sure. But before this time, the European Union has gone alone in their decisions to do this, yet it has got the support of the United States State Department now as well to do this.
All right, we'll fit in a few more quick ones. Robert.
Iran is set to start dumping oil on the markets. Prior to the sanctions, it was producing 1.5 million barrels per day. It was about number 4 in conventional oil reserves. And the day the sanctions came off, they had reports indicated they had 7 supertankers filled and just to the brim with oil ready to set sail. So if you think $28 per barrel is bad, you haven't seen anything yet. Last week, Shell announced 10,000 layoffs. Expect more of that to come. And the impact on debt markets could be pretty big too.
All right, last one, Richard.
Moldova has been going through 2 days so far of political protests. On Wednesday, protesters stormed the legislature. They have just gotten a new pro-European government. Now, the reason why Moldova is significant is this is another potential flashpoint between Europe and Russia. Russia has an enclave within Moldova that it has its troops in, and all of this political upheaval involves pro-European sides and pro-Russian sides. So the political instability there could raise the climate of tension between Russia and Europe.
I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All the stories are in this week's edition. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Robert Morley, Jeremiah Jacques, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall, who next week you'll be in...
Ed Stone joining Richard Palmer.
All right. Thanks to you and to everyone else.
Oh, you're
welcome. Great to be with you.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with the words of Carl Sagan. If you wish to make an apple pie truly from scratch, you must first invent the universe. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.